Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I'm Josh and I'm joined by Thomas.
Hello.
And what we're going to be doing is talking about what is wrong with Western philosophy. And we're going to be going at this from slightly different perspectives because you have a sort of insider view, having formal study of philosophy, whereas I've done most of my study from the outside looking in. And therefore, hopefully, we can get some useful perspectives on the matter.
Yeah, well, there is a profound difference, I must state, from the off between Western philosophy per se, what it actually advocates, and how it's applied in practice. Mm-hmm. At the moment, the way it's applied in practice, not least, well, you just have to look at the state of academia. You can see that intellectual inquiry for so many philosophers is not actually the end for what they ultimately want to achieve out of their academic work. It's partially the reason why I'm here rather than there as a full-time PhD
student. Well, yes, they don't actually want to necessarily pursue the truth as a be-all and end-all. They want to pursue their causes.
Yeah, they do. It has become, you would think that academia, university would pride itself on being an open system of thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's anything but that, or at least particularly in the humanities. It's bad in many philosophy departments, but obviously it's nowhere near as bad as sociology and education departments that I've heard about and seen. And we get letters from evidence of this sent to us all of the time. And it truly is harrowing to see how even just the utter state of Western academic institutions, even though you can still trace this back to serious flaws in certain ideas which have been actualized, it's you would think that skepticism somehow, or at least the skepticism that was cherished in the spirit of postmodernism, critical theory, and the skepticism itself before that, would somehow have renewed its relevance. But instead, mm-hmm. we find ourselves unable to relieve ourselves of dogmatic beliefs. I thought that we got over this when we saw the fetters of religion, for example.
It is unusual that you have things like intersectionalism, which basically encourages prostration to some sort of grand narrative, and yet you have existing at the same time things like postmodernism, which encourages skepticism at everything, more or less.
Yes.
And these two things coexist, quite often taught and somehow believed by the same people, and yet they seem entirely inconsistent with one another, and yet things consistently fall on one side.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost as if there is a unanimous commitment to resignation, to the resignation of pursuing truth and meaning. And I don't know that sounds extremely dogmatic in itself, but everywhere you look, it seems to be the case. And I wish I could say it's a simple case of people acting on things that they genuinely believe in virtue of the fact that the damage being inflicted is due to just bad actors acting on things that we disagree with and know to be wrong. The problem, I think, is much deeper. As in, there are lots. The overwhelming majority of those who are doing the work and doing the damage don't know what they're doing, don't know what that cause is serving. And when we keep coming back to asking what wokeness is, I think it's too simple to conceptualize it as just this collective strive towards an abstract notion of social justice. I think the number of people who actually believe that is a remarkably small number, even smaller as the number who actually understand it. The majority of those are just NPCs who are just following the current thing because they think that because the majority of people are doing it, it must be right in some capacity. When you have the universities proactively encouraging people not to think, how is that going to get any better? Like, what's the result going to be?
Mm-hmm. And I think there's also the sort of circumstantial factors that certainly don't help in that. Certainly in the UK, you have the government more or less bankrolling young people straight out of school to go to university when they're young, impressionable, and when they're most susceptible to conformity, basically. They're in this new environment. They're looking to make new friends. Well, they want to follow a line. They want something to point to that, okay, here's the line. If I cross that, then I'm in trouble. But if I toe the line, then I'll get along with people and keep my head down. And I think that people are more concerned with that than they are with actually seriously pursuing the truth of their discipline
yeah.
a lot of the time. And it's quite a human thing, but it's not necessarily something I can respect.
No, not at all. I mean, it's the easiest thing in the world to be a conformist and just to follow the current thing and just to emulate the behaviours of other people. But that's not to say it has, that of course, it improves you or it improves the world outside of you or even consummates that, that world you think accommodates these ideas. It's the world that we have is and this is one of the genuine achievements of Western philosophy. The world that we've created is a combination of acknowledging that certain moral imperatives exist and that we should have a government committed to defending those things, but also that we should be respected as individuals, as people, so that we can actually hold those principles that are being defended to account and understand why they exist. That part has been under, that individualistic part has been under attack now in institutionally for half a century, perhaps even before that, depending on your conjecture. And my God, it is showing. It is really, really showing. And I'm it's at a point now where I don't think the universities have it within them to turn the tide.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think the only way it could really change is if the government changed its policy and stopped pumping basically young kids into universities that are impressionable. If people actually had to pay for their own course out of their own pocket, they might be a bit more serious about the academic endeavour that they're about to take up. And I think that that's something that's very important. And I think that particularly with the mature students on my courses, they were far more serious about their studies and about the truth. They were happy to disagree because they had that level of maturity to see that actually appealing to your peers isn't really a very good long-term strategy to bettering your own situation.
No. And I think we underestimate just how young 18 is as well. Like it's, I really think that if you made it imperative for students or shall we say people to do 2 years of work in the real world before they can access, for example, a state-funded education, the overwhelming majority of those would think at least a lot more carefully about what they proceed to do, not least because they've directly interacted and made peace with the thing that's ultimately going to accommodate them as a person, civil society. And you build connections at work by having a job. You understand how things work. You become more industrious. When you're in the education system for so long, and then you prolong that and you carry that, you set on the path towards adulthood with that protection, you're almost you're setting yourself up to be an incompetent adult in so many ways. That's not to say that every student makes ill-advised choices because they don't, but we do almost have a system where it's implicit to choose irresponsibly.
It is a bit, university is kind of like an extended childhood in a way.
Yes, it is.
And it's a shame because that seems to have had influence on the way in which academia is structured, in that it's accommodating to these people who basically bankroll their entire system. I mean, they are the sort of gravy train, aren't they? They're the ones that are bringing in the easy money straight from the government for these institutions, whereas if they didn't have this guarantee of this steady flow of students, maybe they would think about being a bit more competitive. They'd certainly lower the cost of tuition to get more people in, and the quality of people going in would probably be higher because they've invested more of their own time and money into it proceeding seriously with it, really.
Do you think that it would help if we actually I was going to suggest what if we removed the votes from students?
because as it
stands, that they actually have serious political power and political influence. You've got an awful a lot of forces of, well, institutions committed to intersectional virtues investing in university projects that directly affect the way that students think and thus the ways in which they vote. You could say that this is kind of a subversive arrangement. If the government thinks that there are lobbyists with considerable capital purposely doing this in a way that's purposely withering away at the fabric of the society that a government is elected to defend, it has legitimacy to consider, you know what, it might actually be in the interest of our voters to remove the votes from students who quite clearly, like, well, maybe I am just being overly dogmatic here.
I think
I've never been a fan of removing the vote from people, to be honest. But
I think that there's no chance of them being able to get away with that, though. That's the thing. People would kick up way too much of a fuss, and it'd be like electoral suicide to be like, "Yes, we're gonna take your voting rights away."
Mm-hmm. it would be a politically stupid decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm just clutching at straws, really. As you know, as to what we can actually do to stop this.
So yes, onto something else entirely. Let's have a look at philosophy's influence on the world when it's even done correctly. And we're going to talk about lots of prominent thinkers and how their ideas have more or less had detrimental effects or contributed detrimentally to society. So it's worth starting off saying, if philosophy as a discipline is concerned with right thinking and morality, then it seems to have failed with some of its most prominent thinkers. For example, Rousseau laid the philosophical groundwork for the bloody French Revolution, and his theories of society provided the rationale for the terror under Maximilian Robespierre, in which 17,000 people were officially executed and perhaps 10,000 died in prison without trial. And this was because of his idea of the society.
I thought during the terror, about 100,000 people were executed, weren't they? Or died, or reported to have died.
Lots of people probably died, but this is official figures and the number of people who just died in prison without trial. Yeah. These are supposedly some hard figures, but it's probably far worse than that, of course. But yes, Rousseau, more or less in his Social Contract, lays out that if you go against the general will, what might be described as the people's will, then you have forfeited your right to belong in that society and you are a traitor, and therefore it is permissible to kill that person.
That's what's implicit in it, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I don't see how that isn't exactly what informed these decisions in the terror, because this idea didn't really exist in the Ancien Régime under monarchy. This is something completely different and at a scale that was unprecedented in French history.
Yeah.
And it's pretty easy to attribute this to Rousseau's teachings, more or less. And you've got to kind of hold the guy accountable for it.
No, you really do. I mean, this was, without, you are right in saying, it was the blueprint for the Jacobin movement and the most radical faction of the, you could say, the anti-Ancien Régime lobby, if you can call it that. But it's worth remembering as well that Rousseau actually started off from a very, very base position in a sense, because his entire contempt for society was constituted on just how narcissistic and vain it was. Like he absolutely hated the fact that you had, for example, royals who offered absolutely nothing to society whatsoever, leeching off of the money that the then young emergent bourgeoisie was making to continue their indulgence in obnoxious, unapologetic consumption, which they were seen to be posturing to those who they were stealing from. It's absolutely no wonder there was resentment building in the streets of Paris, and the economic mismanagement was pretty appalling as well. Mm-hmm. It led to an awful bread shortage to the point where that they actually had to a faction of women actually turned up to the what building is it? The Versailles to actually steal the flour, because they literally had nothing to bake. So if there's ever like a genuine case for radical action, it's when you're literally running out of food to cook and eat. It was just incompetence on an absolutely appalling scale. But Rousseau, by the time you actually reach the end of his philosophy and you understand the system that he's advocating, he ends up back where he started, structuring society on this idea of not being coerced or determined by anything ever. Hence, well, the social contract that the person has with the state, and the ultimate collapsing of that individual will into the general will, which he presents as being a kind of the all-important principle of how society should be structured. But it's amazing how he starts from this position of saying this is bullshit in effect, and the fact that I hate it is enough of a is serves as enough justification as to why I should not participate in it, which I think a lot of libertarians could get behind, and then arrives at just about the most a far more like vain, narcissistic, dogmatic like political structure than the one that he actually set out to destroy.
I think he must accept the presupposition that he is somehow morally superior, and therefore he can make these prescriptions, which is why he doesn't see the irony in what he's setting out.
Yeah. Yeah. As in he sees it as a general principle that, well, literally the general principle, that all the ills of the world as diagnosed by him stand true for every person. And only he either did not believe that, or he was mad.
Mm-hmm. I don't think he was mad.
I think he was fantasizing, really, as he was writing it.
Well,
if he had lived to actually see just how awful the political implications were, I think he probably would have fought again, or at least erred on the Girondin, or leaned towards the Girondin faction.
This is one of the fundamental problems of the practice of Western philosophy, in that too often it seems to be thinking in abstract, in an ivory tower somewhere, rather than actually trying to fundamentally experience something. It's to rationalistically explain how the world is without then backing it up with any experiential, empirical evidence.
Yeah. Well, Adorno is another example of that. He spent nearly all of his academic life using Marxist newspeak and claiming that, well, that this glorious revolution that never happened has left us in this in the world that ultimately gets perpetually worse the more we try to improve it. When he actually sees like students committed to enacting what they believe to be the principles that he'd been advocating for all along, he comes out and says, you know what, this looks like the same fascism that I've spent my entire career trying to resist.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the fact that he didn't see how it could lead to this, this kind of illustrates how his academic position kind of veiled his ability to actually understand what this would look like politically. And that is a legitimate flaw, not only within like Western institutions at the moment, but in the idea that you can theorize how society should be structured before you actually experience them.
Mm-hmm. No, it's impossible, because to theorize about how to restructure an entire society, you've got to already have an understanding of how it is, and then also know how to restructure it, which is pretty impossible considering the number of factors that you need to consider. I mean, no one person can really comprehend all of that information. No. It's just impossible to do it accurately.
Yeah, ironically, that was exactly the conclusion that Adorno drew. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, as critical theorists, we can sit back and assess the absurdities from a distance and sympathize with people and their lived experiences about why this social structure is so bad and oppressive to people. But the second we actually try to change it in accordance to how we view the world, then we're just simply replacing one power structure with another. And, well, then, of course, you then just... nothing has ultimately improved, because it's just another structure of domination. As in, by Adorno's own admission, in the Dialectic of Enlightenment, you cannot apply reason in any way without asserting domination. And if you take that to its full extent, you just end up with something else that looks like fascism.
Mm. But the thing is that you've got to have some amount of reason involved, otherwise you're just going to be stumbling around in the dark.
Well, exactly.
So...
that's why critical theory is a politically impotent philosophy. Excellent critique, and it's extremely useful at deconstructing the self-proclaimed modes of critical theory that are prevalent today. But it has, the second it conducts its extraordinary or finishes its radical critique, the question is asked, then what? And it has no answer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just the term that James Lindsay uses for it, cynical theories, is fundamentally correct.
It's similar to postmodernism in that it critiques stuff without really pushing anything else.
Yeah, it has faith in this notion of critical reason that it will somehow, and this is where the Marxist links are kind of true, that when by the time you actually deconstruct the absurdities and the irrationalisms in everything, economically, socially, and ideologically, then there's going to be this collective awareness that will be facilitated, and then we will just know what to do from there. Whereas the postmodernists would, of course, resign en route to that straight away, or resign that goal straight away, and saying that everything we understand to be in virtue of the moral good corresponds to nothing concrete at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is just a completely arbitrary power structure, not an historical one like the critical theorists would claim.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.